And I'll start by writing my name. That's Gifre. And as John said, I started working, I work at PI now. Well, the idea I think is that this makes sense, this session makes sense if it's interactive. So feel free to ask me questions. I may be asking questions as well. And what do I want to do here? Well, I guess you had a very long day already. How many lectures did you have today? Two. What's that?
And the tutorial.
And what's worse? Anyway, take this as free time if you want, but I have to talk to you. And I think actually it's a good idea that you get exposed to what researchers do. It's a good way of later on being able to choose if you want to do a PhD in physics, what subject you want to take. I remember having to make that decision at the end of my undergrad studies. I had no idea what I was choosing. And yeah, kind of, I still don't know, but let me tell you what I do. So I'll start with a very general question. A recurrent problem in physics or question in physics is they give you a Hamiltonian, a local Hamiltonian. Okay, and then the question we can ask, that's a big question, is what's the ground state of this Hamiltonian? So to give you a couple of examples, we could start with the Ising model. I believe you've been working, you have Mathematica classes or something, and you have to deal with the spins, so you know what this is about. But let me write a Hamiltonian here. In this case, our Hamiltonian could be some, let's make it ferromagnetic, sigma z on side I, sigma z on side j, nearest neighbors, minus some constant, and then a magnetic field, transverse magnetic field. So you might have seen this Hamiltonian. Is that the one you've been playing with? Is that the Ising model? Or did you do Heisenberg?
We played the model.
Which one?
Heisenberg.
Okay, so this is even easier, okay? The cheap version of the Heisenberg model. And what this is telling you, just imagine you had a two-dimensional, I think you've been dealing with the spin chain. Let's make it extremely more fancy, two dimensions. So imagine you have spins on a plane, spin 1/2, degrees of freedom, and they interact according to this Hamiltonian. And what this is telling us, for instance, this term here, this is nearest neighbor, so let's take two spins, nearest neighbors. Let's consider possible configurations of the two spins. They could be up, 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 down, down, up, and down, down. And what this term is telling us is, well, if you are in this configuration, you get a minus one of energy in some units. If you are in the down, down configuration, you also get a minus one. If you are in the, so if you can see this, if the two spins are aligned parallelly, you get low energy. If they are aligned anti-parallel, then you get a plus energy. And in the ground state, we are going to try to get the energy as low as possible. So what this term is telling us is that we would like the spins to be either in this option or that option, okay? Either pointing up or pointing down nearest neighbors. So if we only had this Hamiltonian term, then we would end up with all the spins in the ground state would be pointing up, all of them, or all of them pointing down, right? But we have this other term. And what this term is telling us is that, well, it's a term that takes a spin that is pointing up and tries to flip it so that it points down. And the other way around, if it's pointing down, it will try to make point up. So then we have a Hamiltonian with these two competing terms, and suddenly it's no longer so clear what the ground state is going to look like. And that's a typical question that you want to be able to answer. We understand very well the microscopic degrees of freedom, spin 1/2. We understand how they interact. They interact through this term that tries to align the spins. They also are flipped by another term. And the question is, all right, so now we take, say, 100 such spins, lattice 10 times 10, and we try to answer the question, In the ground state, do we is this object, is this many-body system acting as a ferromagnet? In other words, if this is the ground state, and we look at the expectation value of sigma z in some spin, we could ask the question, is this zero or non-zero? Are the spins pointing on average in some direction? All right, so that would be an example of the question we want to answer. Let me give you another example, a more sophisticated one. And I'm going to do, oh, right, I've been told we have this. Wait. Yeah. So let me talk about the second example. That would be the Haber model. In this case, the Hamiltonian. So what we have in this case is a lattice, say a two-dimensional lattice. And what we have are electrons that can hop between the sides of the lattice. So we could have an electron here. We could have another electron in another side. And what we have is that on each side of the lattice, we have four possible configurations. In one possible configuration, there is no electron. Another possible configuration is such that on that side, we have an electron with spin up. Another possible configuration would be we have an electron spin down. And finally, the other configuration that we could have is that on that side we have a spin up electron and a spin down electron. Okay? So imagine that this is your system. On each side we could have one of those four possibilities. And now what we have is a Hamiltonian. A Hamiltonian in this case says something like there is a kinetic term, so hopping term, with some amplitude t, plus some potential term, which is trying to prevent this situation where the two, I'm going to write repulsion. So basically, the Hamiltonian, the instructions for this problem, the way the microscopic degrees of freedom want to interact with each other are very simple. First, if you are on one side, the electron could hop to the next side with some amplitude, some intensity t. And then, on the other hand, if you had that there are several electrons here and they coincide at some point on the same side, then they experience some repulsion. So they try to not to prevent that situation. If two electrons are freely moving around and end up on the same side, they quickly will try to go away, right? And this is given by this term, the repulsion u. And so here we have again, as in the previous case, two different terms. If we only had one of the two terms in the Hamiltonian, it would be very easy to understand how the electrons are going to be organized in the ground state of the system. But the competition between the two terms makes it much more complicated, right? OK, so these were two examples that I think are useful to keep in mind.
So what would be the configuration if we had the hopping term?
Sorry, if we?
What would be the ground state configuration if we just had the hopping term?
If we only had this one? Well, so in this case, this would be a non-interacting system, and you would be able to solve this exactly, and Fourier transforming and so on. And basically, what you would have is that you could have 20 electrons there. They would not know that the others exist. There is nothing here that tells you. And so it's 20 times the having one electron in there, basically. And one electron would be just moving around freely, so it's playing waves. Right. So we have two typical problems, very simple problems. The highlight here is that it's very easy to describe the microscopic degrees of freedom. Now we have quantum mechanics. The quantum mechanics sets the stage for this type of systems. It tells you the rules, how they behave. But trying to understand, for instance, in this system, whether the ground state of this system is superconducting, that's a model, the Haber model that has been proposed to study superconductors, high temperature superconductivity. And the striking thing is that, well, with the Ising model in two dimensions, there is no exact solution. Nobody knows how to solve that exactly. So you may learn in this year many analytical tools, but you have to, something that should be very clear to you is that when you go to real problems, analytical tools tend to fail. But nevertheless, there are numerical tools that allow us to answer the question of when the quantumizing model in two dimensions, when it shows spontaneous magnetization or not, for instance. So that system is under control. Now, this one here, it was proposed in 1963. Okay, this is a very simple, the simplest model you can think of electrons that interact. It has not been solved yet. Okay, so we don't know yet whether this is a good model for high temperature superconductivity. Actually, it's I'm a bit nervous. They are filming this, and I just said that this problem has not been solved. So I can think of, I don't know, 100 colleagues who would be very upset with me because of what I just said, because they solved it. Okay. The problem is you bring them here in the room, you fill the room with experts on Haber model, and they all have solved it, but you will see that there are 100 different solutions, okay? So there are many techniques. People, they have been really battling with this problem. They've used the best that we have. The solution is not clear, at least it's not unique, the ones that we have, and I would not call it an answer to what the ground state is until we are all convinced. We actually don't know the answer, and you know it's almost 50 years since it was proposed. So, big message then: analytical tools. Well, you can learn a lot from them. Sometimes you have to resort to numerical tools to solve many body problems, and sometimes not even numerical tools can solve problems. This is an open problem nowadays. What's the ground state of the TJ, the Haber model in two dimensions? Okay? And you would think that I know what I work on, but I need to check. So there are this type of question of they give you the rules, they give you many interacting microscopic systems interacting, and you want to answer the question of how do they, these microscopic systems that interact with each other, how do they organize collectively? That's a question that seems to be relevant to condensed matter physics. The two examples that I gave you come from condensed matter physics, but probably after being exposed to, I think, talks from string theories that you had and so on, you realize that they also talk about this type of problems at some level. And actually, you could go now to a quantum chemist, and he would be talking about the Haber model. And so you could also talk to somebody working on nanotechnology. And they face similar problems. So the problem of how many body systems in the quantum case organize collectively, it's a problem that is not specific from quantum, from condensed matter. It's much more general. So what do I do? I'm interested in roughly three areas. One is entanglement. And that could be considered quantum information. Did you have any talk by somebody working on quantum information? No classes, nothing? Okay, quantum information is strong at PI, so I'm sure they'll tell you a lot about this. But I will only touch it a little bit today. The other type of problems I'm interested in is collective phenomena. That would be emergent phenomena as well. So that's quantum many-body problem, quantum many-body. I'm going to leave it like this in general. Here you could think about the emergence of topological order or quantum phase transitions, this type of problem. And then finally, I'm interested in simulation, efficient simulation, or classical simulation. So that would be computational physics. And so what I'll tell you is a little bit about each of these subjects, and you'll see that they are and closely related to each other. So we'll see many connections. But in the end, what I'll tell you is what the approaches that we are dealing with. So these guys are connected. And I'll explain in which sense in a minute. But in the end, what they have in common, or what we're doing at the moment, is something that is called tensor networks. And that sits exactly in the middle of these three subjects. Okay, they have to do with a lot to do with entanglement. We use these tensor networks as a computational technique, and then our goal is to actually understand collective phenomena in quantum many-body physics. Good. So I think I'll just get started with this. I'm really confused with the blackboards, so just bring this up. Then this one, okay. So I actually just learned this, that you've been playing with Mathematica, dealing with the spin chains. So the first thing I want to talk about is a computational challenge. And you know about this already. So suppose that we want to deal with the spin 1/2 degrees of freedom. All right? So if we just have one of those basis for the vector space, the Hilbert space to describe spin 1/2 would be spin up, spin down states. And then what we're saying, I'm actually going to change the notation. I'll call it state 0 and state 1, just because it will make things simpler later on. And now what we have then is that any state of one spin 1/2 degree of freedom can be written as a linear combination of these two, right? And the big question is, where is the computational challenge? Well, you give me two complex numbers, and we have described the state of the system. There is no computational challenge. That's okay. Okay, we can do that. We can now try to do the next step. So suppose that here we had n equal to 1. So let's go to two spins. I think you're familiar with that. If you have, in quantum mechanics, if you have two systems, the Hilbert space for the total system is the tensor product of the two Hilbert spaces. So in this case, if we had two spins A and B, the Hilbert space is going to be the Hilbert space of the first spin times the Hilbert space of the second spin. And what that means actually is that we could choose a basis for the total system for the two spins by taking the following. We define as state 0, 0. The tensor product of the first spin being in state 0 and the second spin being in state 0. And we run through the whole basis by considering a product of basis there. So now, once more, what we find then is that a generic state of two spins, we could write it just as a linear combination of these states. And again, it just takes four complex coefficients, and we can describe the state of the system. So no computational challenge. But of course, there will be one. So if I try to do this for n equal to 3, don't worry, I won't do it. But there will be more terms. How many terms? 8? Right, so let's say here the dimension, I'm going to use this one. Dimension was 2. Dimension is 3, is 4. Now the dimension is 8. And the reason why I'm not going to write this is because it's boring. But this is not the problem with quantum many-body. I mean, yeah, quantum many-body problems can be boring as well. But the big challenge is that if we try to do the generic case of n spins, then the dimension for n spins, the dimension of the vector space, so how many complex coefficients we need to deal with, is 2 to the n. Okay, And now 2 to the n is, okay, well, whatever, polynomial, exponential, you know, some nice function. It has very radical implications. This growth here is really the source of all the problems we have. So nowadays we have extremely powerful computers. We are just ordering a laptop. A laptop says, let's be generous, say you have 1 gigabyte of RAM. Is that realistic? I don't know. Right, my last
so those have 4 gigabytes.
Four.
I'll tell you in a second.
Sorry? That's the right order.
Yes. Right, we're talking about the order. That's embarrassing.
4 gigabytes.
4 gigabytes, wow. All right, you're destroying my argument here. No, it's okay. Suppose it had one. All right, so I checked, and that's 10 to the 3 megabytes, roughly. Look, I have not checked that for a long time. All right, so that's 10 to the, what, 6? Well, I mean, it's mega, right? So it's going to be 10 to the 9 bytes. So, right, so now let's suppose that it takes just one byte to store a complex number. You may want to correct that. That's completely absurd. I think it takes 2 times 64 bits. But since I don't know what a byte is, roughly. All right, so let's suppose that it takes 1 byte to store one complex coefficient. I would like to know how many coefficients I can store here.
1 byte.
Sorry?
1 byte.
Right, right. Yeah, but we're not going to worry about that. I'm being generous here, ignorant and generous. So the idea is that roughly, if you have 10 to the 3, is roughly equal to 2 to the 10. That's the way to think here, okay? So what that means is that roughly here, this is, if 1 byte is equal to 1 spin, sorry, if 1 byte is equal to 1 complex coefficient, this number here, 10 to the 9, is roughly 2 to the 30. Is that correct? All right, so to give you an idea, if it would take you just 1 byte to store a complex coefficient, and you had 1 gigabyte, you could store the state of 30 spin 1/2 particles, okay? So now, Andre comes here with his huge computer, and instead of being able to store 30 spins, the state of 30 spins, he can go and do 32, okay? So congratulations. No, but the idea is that now, instead of your best laptop, you go and you choose a huge computer, all the computers on the earth, whatever, right? And instead of 30, maybe you get 40, 50, I don't know, I didn't do the calculation. But now, let's go back to the question we're trying to answer. We're trying to answer collective phenomena. We're trying to see how many body system organizes. So this is, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, so now I could spend a couple of minutes filling this. This is supposed to be 6 times 6 spins, 36 spins, okay? So Andres' laptop could almost deal with this system. But the point here is that this is not the thermodynamic limit. We would like to understand properties of this, of microscopic systems when we have thousands, millions of spins. And what we can do is almost 30 spins. I've heard, and this is really embarrassing, but on your side now, that you've been dealing with 10 spins with Mathematica, 11?
In?
Yeah, but it's the same.
20 is very easy.
You could do it. 20, right, if you do sparse matrices, right. Okay. So 20, you could push it to 30. But that's it. And it would take a lot of time, okay? So this is really serious. It says that we don't have direct access to many body phenomena unless you consider that 30 spins is already a thermodynamic limit, okay? All right, so this is the big challenge. And I want you to keep this in mind. I mean, again, you'll learn a lot of analytical tools, and analytical tools are extremely useful. They give you insight into problems. But typical problems that you find cannot be solved with analytical tools. then you have to go and try to figure out maybe numerical tools. But if you try to exactly diagonalize your Hamiltonian or to find the ground state, then you find that at most 30 spins.
Are we quantum computers supposed to make this sort of computation easier? Is that one of the
goals? One possible application of quantum computation would be to be able to simulate such systems. Yes. Do you have a quantum computer?
Is there a bit something with n?
Sorry?
Is there exist up to 10 bits?
Right, right. So the funny part is that 10 bits, you could do it with your laptop. Yeah.
Again, 10 spins.
Right. So if, yeah, with your quantum computer, you can do 10 spins. Wow. Congratulations. All right. So this is a problem we have. And now I want to tell you about another issue. Oh, sorry.
It's a question. I understand that N=3 thing, but is there a matter of time involved?
Right. And I didn't mention time. Right.
Yeah. But
it gets worse.
If we have one gig, and then we can make 30 spins, if we want to make 32, would that be, like, how would you incorporate time in that?
So you want to trade time for space? I mean, memory with time, or?
Well, I don't know if there's a, like you see.
Time is not going to make it better, if that's what you are concerned about. So, yes. So it may take longer to.
But for 30 spins, how much time would that take? Is there a way of doing that?
For 30 spins, it could take, so using, right, then the actual calculation, they exploit symmetries, they try to simplify the problem. They don't explore the whole vector space, but only the region that they know the ground state belong to. And so with all that tricks, I guess nowadays, to give you a reference, I think the most they could do with supercomputers would be 40. And that would take weeks of calculations. I didn't check that, but the order of magnitude is weeks. All right, so now let's change subject a little bit. And I'm going to delete this because I don't control all this. So have you heard about entanglement? Does anybody know what entanglement is? Or, I mean, yeah? You know, OK. Do you want to tell us? That is not a tensor product. Perfect. I was going to spend 5 minutes introducing all this. Okay. So entanglement if we just have a Hilbert space of two pieces, A and B, spin one, two spins, for instance, as a moment ago, that would be space of the first spin and the second spin. Then we say that a state is a product state. So my state, remember that a generic state, say psi AB, could be written as a sum of alpha 0, 0 plus, did I just delete this? Oh. One, one. Now, this would be a generic state, but there are states, some states that you can actually write as a state of the first system and state of the second system. And when this happens, we call this a product state. Okay, so that's just the definition. And in general, if they give you a state like this, it's quite hard to know whether it's a product state or not. We'll just run through a couple of examples in a minute. But the question here is, we have that these product states, they are only a subset, a small subset of all the states that two spins could be in. And the rest, so whenever a state cannot be written in this way, then we'll call it entangled state. We'll say this state is entangled. OK? And just don't be misguided by this. So if I ask you whether this state is a product state, The answer would be yes, because we explicitly say that it factorizes into two states. Now, if I give you this state, maybe you might be tempted to say, oh, this is entangled. Okay? And because it's not written as state of one side and state of the other. So maybe that's entangled. And let me try this one as well. So I'm switching back and forth with the notation, but I hope that's clear. Okay, so we also have this state. Now, one of the two is not entangled. Would you know which one? Oh, you've gone through that before. Okay, which one is not entangled? The last one, because? So you can rewrite this as 0 plus 1 and 0 plus 1, right? So when you have an expression here and you see many different terms, don't conclude that that's entangled. It could be non-entangled. And this is an example. If you write it in another basis, you get that it factorizes into two pieces. Okay? All right, so how do we know whether a state is entangled or not? That would be a question that you may want to answer to know about. And there is a trick. There are measures of entanglement. If they give you a state, you can compute this, the value of this measure of entanglement. And if it's non-zero, then the state is entangled. And here, I will only discuss one of these measures. It's the most popular and probably also the most useful. Operationally, so if you went to a lab and you try to prepare states of two spins, state of two spins, and they are far away, the two spins are far away from each other and they don't interact, and you are only allowed to interact yourself with the spin here and then somebody else with the spin on the other side, you would only be able to prepare a product state. If you make a local measurement, your spin will end up in spin up or spin down here. On the other side could be something else, but it's going to be a product, right? Instead, if you want to prepare an entangled state, you would need to take the two spins together and make them evolve collectively. For instance, through some Hamiltonian, like the one we saw before, the Ising model. Okay? That would be a difference. All right, so don't remember what I was saying. Measures of entanglement. So if they give you a state of two parts, A and B, a way to know whether it's entangled or not, and how, and even to be able to say whether it's very entangled or just a little bit entangled, is you can compute the reduced density matrix for one of the parts, say rho A. And this is defined as trace over the other degrees of freedom. You could compute this. Is this right? Okay. You know that. All right. So suppose that you have a quantum system that has been prepared. Say our spin has been prepared in spin up state. It has been prepared on state zero. Okay. Or suppose that. So we can represent this as a vector in a vector space, but we could also represent it as a projector, as a linear operator. That's the same. It's different representations of the same state. And what is interesting about representing it as a linear operator is that now you could ask the question, suppose that with some probability, your state, your spin was prepared in state zero, probability P. And suppose that with some other probability, your state had been prepared in state one. So probability one minus P, your spin had been prepared in state one. So then here you have this object that we're going to call density matrix. Is that new? Density matrix. So so we have a more general formalism that allows us to talk about the states of a quantum system beyond the situation where we have a pure state. We could have a mixture of pure states. Okay? And so the reduced density matrix is the reduced state that you get if you have a system A and B in some entangled state psi AB, and you would like to know properties of your system, properties restricted to A, okay, if you would like to now understand the properties of subsystem A, you don't really need to know the whole wave function. If you're not going to ask a question about B anymore, all you need to know about A and B to answer questions about A is what's called the reduced density matrix rho A. Okay, and it has some definition in terms of the state psi AB, and this definition is actually this one, where you have to trace out these degrees of freedom. And I think we can chat about this later, but yeah, I won't be needing the details. The idea is that if they give you a state, you can compute something else, the reduced density matrix A. And now if you look at the entropy and how much entropy, so I need to define the entropy, but if you look at the entropy of this density matrix, it will tell you automatically whether this state is entangled or not. Okay? So all you have to take from this is that we'll be able to associate, to talk about how entangled a state of pairs A and B is. And the definition here is as simple as this. So given a density matrix rho, you just have to, well, this is, yeah, you can just compute the trace of rho log rho with minus one in front. Okay, that's the definition of the entropy of this density matrix. This is a quantity. There is a lot of justification for this, but yeah, probably I should have thought about how much detail I wanted to go into. I really don't want to go more into detail. It's just a quantity that you can compute from the states that will tell you how much entanglement is there between the two pairs A and B. And for instance, for the case that we were discussing, spin 1/2 particle, this quantity, the entropy, the entropy of the reduced density matrix for A can go from 0 to 1. If it's 0, if the entropy is 0, you have a product state. You don't have entanglement. And for the rest, for all these values, you have an entangled state. And we will say that if you, and it turns out that, okay, so at 0, we would have a product state, for instance, the state 1, 1. State 1, 1 will lead to 0 entropy of entanglement. A state that would lead to entropy equal to 1 would be what we call a maximal entangled state. Okay? And in between, you have many possibilities. For instance, depending on the relative weight between the 0, 0 and the 1, 1 state, you would cover all the spectrum here. All right? So when we talk about entanglement, there is a qualitative definition that says that a state is entangled if it's not a product state. But you can go beyond that, and you can have a quantification. You can quantify how much entanglement your state has once it does. It's not a tensor product. This entropy. It's a property of your state. It tells you how mixed your reduced density matrix is. There is no optimization involved in a straightforward way, at least.
Should it be 0, 1, 1, 0?
You could also have this state. Yeah, these two states have the same entropy, the same entanglement.
Yeah, but 1, 1 is, like, why is the entropy of 1, 1, 0?
This state here?
Yeah, there's a 1, 1, but I thought that 1, 1 was 0.
All right. So if you try to express this state as a product state, part A and part B, you will fail.
Yeah.
And the same happens for this one, for both of them. Okay? All right, so what do we take from here? Well, we have some way of quantifying how entangled our many-body state is, at least a two-body or two-spin state is. Okay? And now we're going to use this to have a look at ground states of many body systems, and we'll learn something quite interesting. So if there are no more questions, I'll move on. So three is ground state entanglement. Remember, entanglement, or this measure of entanglement, intuitively what it's telling you is I am far away from a product state. So the more entangled state is, the farther away from being a product state of the parts is. What we want to do here is we just define some measure of how far away we are from a product state. We call it entanglement entropy, entropy for short, but remember it's a state does not have entropy. It's the reduced density matrix when you just look at part of the system that has entropy. Now, what happened is the following. I think it was back in 2002 or so, we started asking questions such as, we have a spin chain, or later we'll go to the plane. But suppose you have a spin chain, and there is some local Hamiltonian there, and you have the spin chain in the ground state. Suppose that you can compute the ground state. Now you could ask the question, is this, how entangled is this state? Now we just define entanglement in terms of two spins, right? But what we could do is, we could divide our system of many spins into two parts, say this one and this one. We can call this part A and this part B, right? And so the ground state, suddenly we can look at this ground state as a state of two parts A and B. And as such, we could go ahead and compute the reduced density matrix for one half of the system, part A, and we could ask how much entropy is there. And this would tell us about how much entanglement is there between A and B, okay? The two halves of our spin chain. And this is, you know, you can ask many questions in life, right? So why would you ask this? Well, we don't know why we would ask this, but the answer told us that that was a very interesting question to have asked. So the answer is that the entropy, so suppose that there are L spins here. The entropy of a block of size L was roughly in one dimension. So this is in one dimension. The entropy of a block of size L goes as, well, actually it saturates to a constant in the following sense. If I plot here the size of my block and here the entropy, so if I plot the entropy as a function of the size of a block, and I start with a block of size 1, 2 spins, 3 spins, and so on, then I see that the entropy grows until it reaches some constant, and it stops growing. That's what you would typically observe in a one-dimensional system, except that if we also ask the question, what happens if we are at a critical point, a quantum phase transition? What if we have tune the Hamiltonian in such a way that we're going through a phase transition? And then the answer there was, well, this is going to scale like log L. That's, you can do this. You can try to solve a sufficiently large spin chain, get the ground state, compute the reduced density matrix for an increasing number of spins. And then what you see in that case at criticality is that this grows as a log L. Now, why is this interesting? I mean, okay, log L, who cares? Okay, so this is very interesting because we could also ask the question, how much entanglement would a generic state of this Hilbert space have? Okay, so now I just describe results for the ground state of a spin chain, right? But now I could ask, if I choose randomly in the Hilbert space a state, and I look at how much entanglement there would be between A and B, what would be the answer? Well, the answer is roughly the entropy is looking at how many options you have. The dimension of this region here, the dimension of the Hilbert space here, is 2 to the L. And the entropy, to give you an estimate, is typically the log of this, of how many options you have. And the log of this is proportional to L. So if you choose randomly a state in the Hilbert space, it so happens, you have to believe this part, but it so happens that its entropy grows like L. Now, it turns out that ground states, in ground states, the entropy was behaving in a very different way. So in a generic state, the entropy would have been growing straight line. And what we had was non-critical systems, the entropy instead saturates as a function of the block of spins. For critical systems, it grows, but only as log L, which is much slower than L. And for a random state, it would grow as L. You can even imagine that your system is infinite, and now you're looking at the finite region of size L, if you wanted. Okay. So, what do we learn from this? What we actually learn from this is that ground states are not arbitrary states in the Hilbert space. They are very specific. Very specific. So, let's go back to our big problem. What we were saying is that the Hilbert space of n spins. No, pick your coefficient randomly, the complex coefficient randomly. For sufficiently low energy ground states, for sufficiently low energy eigenstates, so eigenstates with very low energy, you'll still have very suspicious behavior, saturation to a constant, or at most logarithmic increase. Okay. For low energy eigenstates, if you go higher up in the spectrum, I don't even know the answer. Now, the Hilbert space of n spins is something huge, dimension 2^n. We get lost. We don't have computational tools to deal with this. But what we just saw, looking at entanglement, was that actually our states belong to some little corner of this huge Hilbert space. Our states are not normal. The ground states that we are interested in are not an arbitrary state in the Hilbert space. Turns out that ground states, the ones that we care for, the ones that we would like to understand, belong to a very small submanifold of this huge Hilbert space. So this is good news. Good news, because it gives you hope that you might be able to understand how to parameterize these states here without having to deal with all the states that you have in the Hilbert space. Okay? And that's exactly what we're going to do with tensor networks. Tensor networks are a way of parameterizing states that live here in this little corner. But this is all we need, because our goal is not to understand arbitrary states in the Hilbert space, it's to understand the physically meaningful ones. Such as ground states, excitations of a ground state, and so on. Okay. So, oh, perfect. I'm running out of time. And I came here a bit earlier to understand how this works. And I drew something. Okay. So. Here's the end of this presentation. What I want to tell you is that here are tensor networks. What tensor network are, what a tensor network is it's a relatively complicated but computationally efficient way of encoding many coefficients of for a spin to describe the states of many spins. So in a tensor network, let's take the first case. What we have is we are trying to describe the state of n spins. And the wave function of this n spins, I can represent it in terms of coefficients. So this is the type of states we were trying to express. And the problem we had was that each index takes two values. So here we have 2^n coefficients. Now I'm going to use a diagrammatic notation to talk about tensors. You can think of this as a tensor. A tensor, I'm going to represent it as a circle. And then for each index that your tensor has, I'm going to draw a leg. So if you see a circle with n legs, that's the representation, actually, for this all these 2 to the n coefficients that we have here. And so in the same way, if I just wanted to represent a vector, vi, that would be my vector, one index, one leg. If I wanted to represent a matrix, that would be how I would do it, a circle with 2 indices, and so on, right? I could try to represent objects with 3 indices, and so on. Now, on top of that, I need to tell you one more thing, and then we can understand those pictures. If I have 2 tensors, and they have a common leg, automatically you have to think there is a sum over that index. So for instance, this thing here, from outside you see that there are no open legs. So this should be just a number, right? So in here, if I just have a circle without legs, that would be some number x. So if I now represent 2 such objects, this would be 2 vectors, right? It's circle with which an index. So this could be vi, this could be wi. And then what I'm telling you is that if they share this leg, then there is a sum over that index. So this thing here could be the scalar product of 2 vectors. For instance, how would I represent the multiplication between a vector and a matrix? So this would be my vector. This could be my matrix. Now, if I want to represent the multiplication of a vector times a matrix, I just draw them this way. Okay? And the result, obviously, has one open leg. It's a vector, right? If you multiply a vector times a matrix, you get a vector. So now a question for you, just to check, and then we can move on. Suppose I give you this. What is this? The trace of a matrix. Okay. So what if I give you this? It's the trace of the product of matrix. Okay. I think we're ready. Good. So now look at this. What this is each circle you see here is a tensor with a number of indices. Well, how many indices? This one has 3 indices, 3 legs. Okay. And this collection of tensors, these tensors are multiplied together, okay, to form a tensor network. The network is different in different tensor networks, but the idea is you get a bunch of tensors connected in a given way. And the idea then is that, let's go back here. This was also a tensor with many legs. And what we will do is we will express this tensor. We'll replace it, we will approximate it with a collection of smaller tensors, such that the number of legs that we have open in the end is the same that we started with. Okay? So why is this a good idea? Let's have parameters. We already said this tensor depends on 2 to the n parameters, and that is not affordable. Okay? Let's look on the other side. Suppose that each index here, say alpha, goes from 1 to some value chi, and this value is some constant. Then how many, so a typical tensor in this matrix product state, that's the name of this tensor network, would have, well, this index takes chi values, this index takes chi values. This index here is the physical index, takes only 2 values. So the number of coefficients that we have to use to specify this tensor is chi square times 2, right? It's the number of all the options for all the indices. So there we have it, because in this case, here we had 2 to the n coefficients. Now what we have is, roughly speaking, n such tensors. And each tensor has 2 chi square coefficients. So the total number of coefficients that we're going to use here is linear in the system size. Okay? It's linear in the system size. It's not exponential in the system size. So if we use this structure to represent our ground state, we can get to systems thousands and thousands of spins. All right? That's the trick. Now, Why this is a good trick is something that I would like to explain, but time is up. Okay.
Even for smaller n, do you reproduce the same ground states, or did you get something different?
Right. So it turns out that this question you just asked, the answer depends on the ground state you have. If you are here where the entanglement saturates, then the matrix product state is an extremely precise tool. You get machine precision in any question. So the approximation that you get by representing the ground state using this variational ansatz, this tensor network, is machine precision, okay, with 1,000 spins.
How do you know for 1,000 spins?
How do I know? Right, right. So then you have to play with what you have at hand. If it's a new problem, you will never know whether you get the exact answer or not. But you have exactly solvable models. That's another context where exact solutions are useful. So you could consider the Ising model in one dimension. In that case, you can, that's the same as free fermions, and you can exactly diagonalize that and get 1,000 spins without a problem and compare. Near criticality, actually, good question. Near criticality, this guy, this matrix product state would not work as well. But luckily, we have alternatives. So near criticality, you could use this one. Now I feel like I'm selling something here. If you have a critical problem, you could use this one, which is called, it's called multiscale entanglement renormalization ansatz. And you see that your lattice is down here. And this one extends in an additional dimension that has to do with scale, energy scales in the system. You encode properties corresponding to different energy length scales in your system in different tensors. Okay? And so, yeah, I think time is up. I think you have an appointment or tea, something. Is that right?
You're invited.
Oh, okay. Right, I'll come.